Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of The Media Twits is brought to you by CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, offering an intensive, cutting-edge, three-semester Master of Arts in Journalism and a unique one-semester advanced certificate in entrepreneurial journalism, and CUNY JCamp, a series of continuing professional development workshops focused on emerging trends and skill sets in the industry. Learn more at journalism.cuny.edu.
Filling in for Rafat Ali is Stacey Kramer from Paid Content. Welcome from Florida.
Hi there. I'm actually in a Starbucks on Federal Highway between Fort Lauderdale and my parents. and so they've kindly picked us up at the airport, and you know we found the nearest Starbucks with Wi-Fi, and so they're all around me my whole while I'm doing this, but being very patient about it. So anyway, I hope all of you enjoy the podcast Verite, because occasionally you will have the sounds of Starbucks. Although they did turn down the music, they were very sweet about it.
We should be clear that Starbucks is not a sponsor of Media Twits.
No, Starbucks is not a sponsor, but you know, it's sort of funny because I've been using Starbucks since basically the day they lit the ability to use Wi-Fi. I mean, to use Wi-Fi in the Starbucks. It was right after I got my first Wi-Fi card at a conference in Aspen, and I was in Denver, and they actually went live with it, and I was one of the people who paid for it for a long time.
Right.
And so I sort of got, you know, used to the idea that when I'm traveling and I need to do something, I can do it here. I can also go to McDonald's, but I can't always count on having a space to work in at McDonald's. McDonald's is not a sponsor either. But, you know, when you travel as much as I do, you just sort of get used to the fact that you have places you can go to work. And you file them away mentally, and usually that's where you aim for when you're stuck, because the alternative is just not doing what you need to do. And I need to be portable. This is how I do it.
Yeah, there was a great story in The Atlantic about Freelance Nation and how so many people are now freelance. But it's also even people who are working full time. You know, it's a virtual nation too, because so many people are working out of homes, out of Starbucks, out of wherever they can. At one point, I worked out of there was an ice cream shop in Bernal Heights in San Francisco called Maggie Mud's that offered internet access, and I worked out of the ice cream shop, and the guy there actually did tech support so that I could, you know, to make sure I'd be able to come there every day to do work. So it's really interesting.
And I actually have several places locally where they give me the password or so I can work, and also one in New York across from our office where I have the password. So it's, you know, people can be really accommodating as long as you're respectful of it. I found that over the years, I've been virtual for a very long time, whether I was when I was independent, when I was on staff. And what I found over the years, as we hire people at Paid Content, one of the hardest things sometimes for people who've been in an office to get used to is working with a number of people who aren't tethered to an office.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so it's an interesting dynamic all around.
So the big news this week, I mean, one of the big stories was Hurricane Irene, which just bared down on the East Coast and caused so much damage. What was your experience in that? Now, were you in New York? Where were you when all that came down?
Well, I was in New York when it was getting started. So let's see, I was in New York for the earthquake, which we covered on last week's.
Right.
So I believe. And as Hurricane Irene headed towards us, my parents, who live in South Florida, were getting a little agitated by the fact that two of their children were in New York and were calling us to make sure we were leaving. I was lucky and was able to take my regularly scheduled flight out on Friday for St. Louis. And it was just fine. But my brother had to scramble to get out ahead of time, and we got a colleague out who was supposed to leave for London the next day. And the more I looked at it, the more I said, you know what? It's not that I'm panicky about the storm, but I'm watching all the services shut down in New York, and I think you just ought to leave because it was watching it just sort of, it's like watching sidewalks roll up, in slow motion for a while there. Just things were just disappearing, and you know, I'm one of those people who doesn't think you can overhype something like that. If overhyping means alerting people to possible danger and letting them know how to avoid it. I've been on a levee when it started to break. I've covered floods that, you know, where people waited until the last minute to do something with their house and lost everything. And I've seen people who prepared for everything and still had massive damage, and people who survived because they prepared. And so I just don't think you can overprepare. And I was really irritated with the people who were immediately jumping on anyone who was talking about the possible dangers of Irene.
Yeah, and you really saw that on social media too, and on Twitter. I mean, you saw a variety of people kind of freaking out in the lead up and then making jokes and making fun of it afterwards. And I mean, you always get that in social media, but I think in this case, there was just so many people affected by it one way or the other that you really had that kind of extreme of people who were, you know, going one way or the other, had a very strong opinion about it. And you know, it's just why have these arguments about things like that? Like, let's help people out when they're in trouble.
Well, yeah, and now I think there's a lot of things that we can do, both to help people and, you know, we help people recover from this, but also just the same way that a lot of the coverage of this storm was a reaction to Katrina.
Yeah.
And to the way that people ignored Katrina or didn't cover Katrina a certain way, just as the government reaction was a lot of it a response to what have we learned from Katrina?
That's
we've
true.
Learned we've learned to take care of people. We've learned to be safer about what we do.
So this week we'll talk a little bit more about that with our guest from CNN. I'm sure he'll have something to say about what happened with Irene. But let's talk about just this, what we'll be covering on this episode. The big story is that CNN bought the iPad aggregation app Zeit for somewhere between $20 and $25 million. CNN is saying they're going to run it as an independent company underneath kind of the CNN umbrella, and we'll have Casey Estenson, Senior VP and General Manager of CNN.com, to come on and talk more about that purchase. And the other big news is the Justice Department has sued to block the merger between AT&T and T-Mobile, which would have created a very large, the largest carrier in the U.S. The Justice Department saying that it would have hurt competition and hurt consumers and raised prices. So we'll talk about that second. First, let's start with CNN buying Zeit. Let's bring on Casey Estenson. So Casey Estenson is Senior Vice President and General Manager at CNN.com. He's responsible for all aspects of CNN.com's business endeavors. He's previously with the Walt Disney Company, where he oversaw digital media businesses across the company's online, on-demand, mobile, broadband, and wireless products. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess our first question is, you know, you guys just purchased Zeit. Why do that now? Is there a certain timing for why you thought this was the right time to do it? This is a startup, kind of somewhere along its kind of early to middle mature phase. What was the timing on this like?
Well, I think there's a macro timing here, which is that personalization and the technology that enables the deduction of somebody's interest through their social media or RSS reader usage, and the tablet market coming now into you know, full bloom, have sort of converged to create the perfect opportunity for this type of technology. And it's something that we, I think, identified strategically, I would say, a year ago or so. And we started to take a look at whether or not we wanted to build that technology ourselves, or if there might be a strategic play for us to make an investment or an acquisition. And when Zeit launched in March, we saw a product that, frankly, we just fell in love with. We felt that it was a great consumer product backed by a really powerful technology, and it just fit into our portfolio now.
I know this has been brought up before about, you know, the question of can Zeit remain agnostic, etc. Is that something that, you know, we know that you believe that's not going to change and that it'll run independently. How much collaboration will you have with Zeit? Where do you see kind of the synergies coming from?
Well, the first thing is, as we've said pretty much everywhere we can and as emphatically as we can, it's our intention to keep Zeit as a standalone and independent entity. One of the things that I think is challenging for many traditional media organizations is to get that sort of outsized, aggressive, entrepreneurial innovation. And I would say humbly, I think we do a pretty good job of it at CNN Digital. But at the same time, you know, it really was important to me that we have a footprint in San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, and that we nurture a startup like Zeit to be able to go at its own pace and to kind of play by its own rules, and really grow as a product in its own right. And it's got a solid base of users who love it for what it is. And so it would be foolish of us to acquire it and then alter that fundamentally. I think that would be bad for the user, it'd be bad for the product, and frankly, it would therefore be bad for us.
Casey, how many users does it have currently?
Well, we're not talking specifically about the number of users, Stacey, but what I can say to you is that the people who use it all the time. And one of the keys to the product is that the more you use it, the more engaged you tend to get with it, because it becomes smarter about your interests and the types of things you like to read and see. And so I think the engagement metrics were probably, you know, one of the key drivers of us making this decision.
Well, you know, when Zeit first came on the scene, one of your sibling companies, Time, sibling media outlets, was one of the ones that sent a cease and desist letter demanding that Zeit stop using its content the way it was. How did that affect, I mean, that sort of the existence of that cease and desist action and the response of publishers, how did that affect your thinking as you were going into this?
Well, I think Zeit was a different product than it is now. And I mean, this actually speaks a little bit to the innovation curve. I mean, that was really only, you know, six, nine months ago at this point. Since then, Mark Johnson has come on as their CEO, and they've made some fundamental changes to the product that I think, you know, protect IP and copyright creators fundamentally. And that is, you know, namely that content is served up in a combination of a reader mode and a browser mode, depending on the publisher's preference. You know, the web in general and CNN.com specifically cross links to all kinds of sites. We do some of that through formal business partnerships and arrangements. We do some of that through just being good web citizens, if you will, editorially. Linking to all kinds of players, and it's my belief that same economy of linking will come to the tablet space. It will come to the mobile space in a reinterpreted way, and you know, I feel like it's important for us to be there, and I feel like CNN Digital has a particular expertise in that we could help Zeit with.
What, and you guys at CNN have been really on the forefront when it comes to using social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. I mean, you just see it. It's really intertwined in a lot of the broadcasts. What have you learned from doing all that? What's been good? What hasn't worked? What have you learned so far using social media?
Well, for all of that, Mark, we've also been probably most lampooned by The Daily Show on a regular basis.
No question.
It's a dual-edged sword. But I'd rather be making that bet as an organization to be on the cutting edge of embracing new technologies and really trying to empower our users in every way possible than not doing anything. And one of the things that I think we've seen most forcefully is that, you know, social media engagement increases usage of your content. You know, really under the simple notion of if somebody I know recommends an article or a piece of content, I'm far more likely to read that or look at that or engage with that content. The thing that's interesting is the social media stream as it exists today is generic. It's not necessarily the most intelligent thing out there. And that's one of the things that was compelling to us about the Zeit technology was that we could take the social media data and really start to dig into that in a much more specific level of detail, where we could discover groups of people who are interested in certain subjects, and that should help with the creation of news content and ultimately maybe even how CNN points some of its editorial resources.
There's something that a lot of people forget because in sort of all the talk about social media and all the advances and efforts that have been made now, and that is that CNN was actually very far ahead of the concept of having audience engagement in a variety of ways, with a show that sort of lent itself to caricature sometimes, but it was called Talk Back Live. It debuted in August of 94. And Talk Back Live at various points enabled you to do camera calls. It enabled you to do all kinds of things long before a lot of the things that we call social media now existed. And so I think it's been fascinating for me to see this sort of, you know, maybe sort of the way we sort of tend to forget history in some respects a lot of the time. But in this case, CNN has continually come back, no matter who is running it, no matter who's running the sites or the network, has come back to this idea that you need to have engagement on a variety of levels.
I think you're absolutely right, and I appreciate you pointing out that history. You know, CNN was founded by a maverick and Ted Turner, even though he's no longer involved in the company. Yeah, I think it's a long history of disruptive technology. The notion of a 24/7 cable news network was probably as disruptive to broadcast news as anything. So I believe that that's just in the DNA of what CNN is, and certainly we're just doing our best to kind of carry on that heritage.
There's one other aspect to all this that I think, you know, that was interesting to me, and that is with Zeit and acquiring it. The Washington Post company went in a slightly different direction with their news aggregator, Trove, in acquiring a company and then using that technology to build their own personalization service. I like Trove a lot. I find Trove to be useful to me in ways that Zeit isn't. I find Zeit useful in ways that Trove isn't necessarily. But I like the way that Trove surfaces topics and the way that it works. They've spent in the low millions, putting this all together. How, you know, I know you're not going to talk about cost, although the price that's been out there is 20 to 25 million, and feel free to tell us that that's right on target or off base. but why decide to buy it all at once instead of building your own? Because you've done a lot of build your own too, Casey.
Well, we have, Stacey, and I can't comment on Washington Post transactions other than to say I very much like the Trove product as well. But, you know, I think that we saw something here that was really a combination of three things. Number one, it's a pre-existing product that has a user base that loves it, and there's value to that. Number two is there's a very powerful technology behind this, so beyond the consumer product, the application itself, we really felt that the technology was sound and frankly best in class, and looking at a lot of others. Something that I think actually the Zeit product needs to call out more is how good its technology is and how much value that can bring to the consumer. And then the third piece is the management team. And unfortunately, Mark couldn't join us today because he's on a plane. He's a really seasoned player. He's got a lot of ambition and energy, and the team that he has behind him is really strong. And these guys come out of a deep semantic learning, machine learning, and search background.
So we were talking a little bit earlier about Hurricane Irene on a little bit of a different subject, and just the way that the media covered it this time, and how things played out in social media, and how there was this kind of, you know, was it overhyped, was it underhyped, you know, how it did you see something, you know, being at CNN and watching how the signals came through online? That did you get? Did you learn anything from that, or was it? Did you come off with any kind of view on that?
Well, you know, I would say as a citizen, I don't think you can over-report a hurricane. Right? There really is only one response, which is to get people out of the way of potential harm. So it's hindsight is always 20/20, but the alternative is far worse than people not getting out of the way. What we saw in this is that the storm cut such a wide swath. I mean, really starting in the Caribbean and moving all the way up the East Coast and so deep into the U.S. And frankly, a story that's still going on today, right? I mean, the devastation of the story is actually just playing out in Vermont and upstate New York.
But I mean, do you do anything? You know, did you do anything differently at the .com? To manage something like a crisis like this, we can see very clearly on, you know, on the air what's sort of being done. But how do you handle things on that level?
Well, I think the primary thing for us was that our use of iReport. I mean, I think both of you guys are familiar with our citizen journalism wing, if you will, and iReport.
Sure.
And we created something called an open story, which you know, I'm happy to share the link with you guys. But the open story takes all of CNN's reports from its reporters in the field and stitches those together with reports that are coming in from regular people submitting videos or audio or photos, and then lays it against a map. And that's sort of like data visualization meets traditional journalism meets citizen journalism, I think gives a real depth and breadth of coverage that frankly would have been impossible to do just, I mean, even 5 or 10 years ago. And we've seen that happen in the Arab Spring in Egypt. We've seen that happen in Libya. And now with this Hurricane Irene story that came up the East Coast, that combination of regular people submitting their view of the story mixed with traditional reporting being a pretty powerful combination when done right.
No question. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you both. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
So our next story is about the Justice Department is suing to block AT&T, the merger between AT&T and T-Mobile that would have created the largest wireless carrier in the U.S. This is a huge move in the antitrust division by the U.S. that, you know, the Obama administration has kind of initially said it would, you know, look to more to make more of these kind of antitrust moves, but really hasn't done a lot. The Comcast merger was one big media merger where they made Comcast make a lot of concessions. Do you think this is going to be the same kind of thing, like that this might end up, rather than being drawn out? I know AT&T is trying to get a kind of a quick hearing on it. Do you feel like this is something where AT&T just might have to make concessions, or do you think this whole deal might just die?
You know, it could just die, and, you know, Deutsche Telekom doesn't want it to. It desperately does not want it to. And they own T-Mobile, and they would very much like T-Mobile and AT&T to merge. They would like the money from that, and they would like to be done with it. You know, AT&T has, in its various guises, been through some complicated mergers before, and it has managed some of them. A lot of people may not remember that the biggest merger that Comcast went through before NBC Universal was actually with AT&T and picking up its cable operations.
Right.
It was an extremely complicated process. I remember I at one point had two shelves full of paperwork just about that merger, because you had to go like literally local agency by local agency for permissions. This is different. This is something that people are sure, you know, have gotten this idea. They're sure it has to be bad. And because they're so sure it has to be bad, I don't think they're a lot of the critics are capable of seeing any reason it could be good. And that makes what Justice is doing a little easier, a little clearer cut. I'm surprised that they moved so fast. I'm surprised that they went straight to a lawsuit. You could say this is a negotiating tactic, but it's really not one you need to have.
Yeah, I was also surprised. I just saw that Bloomberg News did this kind of unsigned editorial, basically coming out and strongly in favor of what the Justice Department's doing. And just said, you know, consumers really would have lost in this deal, generally because T-Mobile was such a powerful. I mean, okay, their profits aren't doing as well, but they're offering such a cheap deal on mobile and on data that you don't get from the bigger players. You don't get that from AT. And in fact, the funny thing is, I think even right after this merger was announced, they started running these ads, T-Mobile, and I'm sure the timing wasn't, you know, thought about ahead of time, but they were doing these ads kind of slamming AT&T for, I think, maybe even over price, right as they were being bought by AT&T.
Of course they were, because that's what you do. That's how you do this kind of thing. You know, I think it's a little rosy to think that T-Mobile can indefinitely keep pricing that low. And, you know, one of the like little tiny ironies here is that actually there may have been more of a commitment to that in a merger than there is in a business plan. If you think about it.
Well, but there are some cut rate carriers that seem to be doing okay, like the Metro PCSs and people like that. I mean, they're out there. I think they're profitable, maybe just not as profitable.
Well, yeah, and I think that AT&T and T-Mobile would argue that that is exactly why the issue of competition isn't the same kind of issue that it's made out to be. Now, I'm not saying this is the case, but there is competition out there. There are other services. There is, you know, US Cellular. There is Metro PCS. There are other options out there that people can choose. But to say that the reason you should keep T-Mobile is because it has a low price now, and that's why it should be separate, is really like saying, we can read the future and we know that they will always keep the price low and that they won't change their way of getting customers and they won't change their way of doing business. And all you have to do is look at Sprint to know that's not the case necessarily.
Right.
Or at any of the other cable.
That's true.
But
you also might look into the future and say, okay, what are the odds that AT&T will keep that low after they buy them? I mean, the odds are it seems like it's more likely that the prices are going to rise with AT&T than without.
I that's very possible. I would just say that one of the things in a merger is one of the bargaining points that the government has, and that critics have, is you get to say, look, for X amount of time, we want to guarantee that you're not going to do X, Y, or Z. And
so they could actually make that as a contingent that they could not, they have to keep the rates lower.
Or that they have to continue to offer those plans, not that they have to keep all the rates lower, but that they have to continue to offer competitive plans.
Maybe the Justice Department could make a contingency that AT&T actually has to, you know, provide decent coverage in some of the big cities, and maybe they get more support that way.
Well, you know, that's actually where a lot of this comes from. AT&T saw a way to take what would otherwise be an investment in expansion, and it still will be an investment in expansion, and expand by acquiring, which is not an unusual thing. Expand its abilities. They wanted T-Mobile's capability, T-Mobile's network, and T-Mobile's plans to be part of theirs, and to expand their ability to reach markets and to have the most advanced systems possible.
So we also have, you know, another big topic that's come up today, specifically when we're recording this podcast, is this is the day that Netflix is changing its pricing plan, which has taken a lot of heat for that. They've had to apologize. They've had to apologize for the way that they've handled it, etc. And now there's news that just coming out about Starz not renewing with Netflix. How much of an effect do you think that's going to have on Netflix? And maybe they'll have to lower the price again, huh?
Well, I, you know, no. I mean, if Starz was all the programming Netflix had, there'd be a bigger problem. But
right.
You know, Starz has been an important part of Netflix. It was certainly a part of getting people in the door. And Starz will continue to provide programming through February. But Starz had run into a series of issues, including one that caused them to pull access to one movie studio stuff in particular, because Netflix grew so fast that it outpaced the deals that Starz had in place for how many times it could stream content or how much it could be delivered. And so Starz has been working on that. I think they hoped for a really big deal. When they started with all this, Netflix was really the only place you could make this kind of deal. And Netflix is not the only service anymore. Hulu Plus is out there, although whether they would pay Starz prices, I don't know. And they're on the block now as well. Hulu is on the block.
And, right, of course.
You know, and Amazon is out there, expanding its streaming service. Amazon has a rental service, unlike Netflix, where you can watch a movie at a time. But Amazon also has something called Amazon Prime Instant Video, if I've got all the words in the right order, where if you're already a subscriber to Amazon's $79 a month membership package that gets you lower shipping prices or free shipping.
Or it's $79 a year.
$79 a year. I apologize. Yeah, $79 a year. No, not $79 a month. $79 a year.
That would be the most expensive plan
yes,
out there.
Sorry about that.
$79 a month. You should be able to get every movie you ever made for
right.
that much.
That would be like that Quest commercial. $79 a year. You get certain things. I have that package. Because I have that package, I also now have access to thousands of videos of movies and TV shows, instant streaming, at no charge. They're included in that package. And so people are looking at that now and saying, well, wait a minute, should I get the Amazon thing? Maybe it covers everything I'm interested in. I don't need Netflix, and I get free shipping from Amazon.
Right.
So there's all these different dynamics in place. So you look at what's happening with Starz. That comes in a 24-hour period when Hulu launched in Japan.
That's right.
Early this afternoon, Japan time, early the afternoon of the first Japanese time, and now has a subscription service that runs close to $20 a month with no ads in Japan. And at the same, and then within hours, basically, YouTube announced that it was expanding its movie rentals to Canada. Now, of all the services, it's really the smallest in many respects, but that there is choice out there that wasn't there before in a big way.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I mean, that is exciting when you think about it. That, I mean, when we were talking about AT&T and cellular and carrier wireless carriers and how, you know, how much competition there is or isn't and merging and all that. And I mean, it's great to see so much competition in all these different video services and streaming services. I mean, they're all caught in, they can't, it's not as much, I don't know if you'd say it's a level playing field or not, but the fact that they all have to somehow make deals with all the content creators, that's like part, the big part of the game for them.
Well, it is. And it's a significant, I mean, it's significant. No, it's not a level playing field. It's nowhere near a level playing field. Netflix is by far, you know, ahead, has the most programming right now, has the most status. But it's at a crucial time for Netflix, where what Netflix is doing right now is it divided its DVD service and its streaming services. And as of today, you don't get a break for getting both. You have to pay separately for each. And for people who use both services, it's a considerable price increase. Or it forces people to decide what matters most to them, the ability to watch a DVD and order as many DVDs as you want, and have a broad catalog to choose from, or the ability to watch something instantly from a smaller group of programming.
Right, and it's like you're paying more and you're getting less is what's happening with Netflix. I mean, if they're going to start losing some of the content, or they're going to start kind of battling against the studios, it's going to be a tricky thing for them because they're raising the prices and then they might lose content.
Well, you know, it's really sort of hard to quantify right now that in February, Netflix will have less content than it would have before Starz joined. You know what I mean? It's not like
right.
Starz drops out and there's nothing that they've added since then, because they've added a lot since then.
That's true.
So it's not the same thing. It's not like Starz is 90% of what they offer, and when they're gone, you know, there's only 10% of the programming left.
No, but I guess the question is, will others follow suit? I mean, you've got a lot of studios that are probably reconsidering Netflix and thinking of them in a different light now.
Well, but they're making deals that way too. And you know, not everyone had long deals, or some people have shorter deals that have renewals, or these deals are all being, you know, formed in different ways. Some companies haven't done any deals at all because they're not ready to commit. Or they've done very short-term things to test the waters. And some have come out and said, you know, yeah, we're going to make deals for certain things. And so you have CBS, which has a multi-year deal now with Hulu in Japan for its, you know, its content. But it also has one, it also has deals with Amazon, and it has deals with Netflix.
Yeah. And in an even bigger sense, this whole kind of argument about or the push and pull between, you know, kind of content companies and an aggregator, which is Hulu, is similar to what we were talking about with CNN and Zeit. You know, how does a content company, does a media company, you know, owning an aggregator, like, how does that work? Does it work? Does it not work? I mean, that's still not really clear. You know, it's still a kind of a tricky proposition, and some can make it work and maybe some can't.
Right. Well, whatever happens with Hulu, whatever happens with Netflix or any of these, the age of experimentation isn't over. What we do have right now, though, is an age where content creators have more places to sell old content than they've ever had before. And
well, it's like the golden age of reuse and repurpose.
Exactly. And so, you know, Leslie Moonves has been masterful at this at CBS. You will never ever be able to figure out as many ways to sell numbers over and over again as Leslie has figured out. And
play the field. You know, why not play the field? Just be everywhere.
Well, they've done that. They stayed away from being an equity partner in Hulu, and they decided to go in a different direction. You know, and yet there they were, part of the Hulu launch in Japan. Now, one of the things that people here are going to be a little envious about, and we're going to hear some of this, I think, is, well, they don't have ads on Hulu in Japan. Why do we have to have ads? Because you're only paying $8 a month.
That's
true. You know, they're paying.
And they're getting, and there's even more ads here. I'm noticing, I have Hulu Plus here, and I notice that, you know, what used to be a 30-second ad break has now turned into a minute ad break.
There are more ads, but it's still the lowest amount of ads that you will get in a lot of the same situations for seeing the same shows. And remember, you still can't go watch those shows on Netflix this year. Even at an 8-day delay on Fox, you can only see those shows on Fox.com and Hulu right now.
Right.
And that is something that they need to milk as long as they can. But you will hear people say over and over again, I would pay to not have ads. No, they usually won't, because they won't pay what it's worth. I don't know if $18.50 or $20 is the right price to not have ads, but trust me, I have yet to see one of those things where people say, I would pay to not have ads, end up supporting a service. And I think you can ask Salon about that.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. The co-host is Stacey Kramer, the editor and executive vice president at Paid Content. We want to thank our special guest, Casey Estenson from CNN.com. And we want to thank our sponsor, the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.